Good morning, everyone. This is the Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. And this morning, our guest speaker is Julie Layton Phelps, who is one of the nurse consultants from the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. Good morning. Welcome, Hi. Julie.
How are you, Linda?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Pretty good on this snowy day in Collingwood.
Yes, it's very cold as well. So let's get started, Julie.
Yes.
What article have you chosen to talk to us about today?
Well, Linda, I have selected an article on a topic that may be unknown and possibly controversial to some. The article title is Changing Practices in the Use of Continuous Sedation at the End of Life, a Systemic Review of the Literature. Some of the several authors include Madeline Hazitz, who's a physician, Jezeline Van Thiel, who's a PhD, and Judith Reitens, who's also a PhD. This literature review article was obtained from the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, volume 60, number 4, from October 2020, so it is fairly recent.
And could you summarize the objectives of this article for us?
Sure. This article compares the indications of use of palliative or continuous sedation in different countries with different subpopulations. In recent years, the use of palliative sedation has increased for various reasons. Exploration of these reasons is imperative for the safe and ethical use of this treatment option at the end of life.
And could you explain for our audience a brief review of what continuous palliative sedation actually is?
Sure, Linda. As many as you are aware, there may be severe and intractable symptoms present at the end of life. Some of these intolerable symptoms could be pain, anxiety, breathlessness, vomiting, seizures, or delirium. By definition, continuous sedation until death, which is a term used mostly in this article, is a last option treatment for patients when their intolerable suffering cannot be relieved by regular symptom management. It is the intentional lowering of a person's level of consciousness to relieve their symptoms. It is not the same as sedation related to side effects of other medications like opiates. The level and type of sedation varies from intermittent to continuous reduction of level of consciousness or awareness, and from a light level to a deep level. It depends on the goals of the care of the patient and family and the reason for the sedation.
And what is the criteria for someone to actually access this treatment option?
So obviously informed consent of the patient if they're able, or the power of attorney or SDM, substitute decision maker, is imperative. There must be a DRNR, do not resuscitate order, in place. Life expectancy is usually less than 2 weeks. They must also be experiencing one or more refractory symptoms, which treatments have not been successful. Input from a palliative care team is usually warranted because this is an advanced specific treatment. Also determining the level of sedation with the goals of care. Do they just want a light sedation, or do they want to be completely unaware of their symptoms and their surroundings?
So as we both know, and with our experience with any treatment, there are disadvantages to proceeding with terminal sedation. Could you explain some of these?
Sure. There are certainly various disadvantages to using continuous sedation. Firstly, this procedure is a specialized intervention requiring a medical practitioner who has advanced palliative knowledge. Also, nurses monitoring the patient and sedation also need additional training. Some healthcare professionals may not feel comfortable with this treatment and need to be aware of their self-biases. In addition, patient and families need to be aware once sedation has started, the patient will lose the ability to communicate, eat, or drink, and make decisions in regards to the care. Continuous sedation is not a form of or substitute for medical assistance in dying. The intent of continuous sedation is to alleviate suffering, not to hasten death.
So can terminal sedation be used for non-physical symptoms?
So usually it is not, unless the symptoms are consistent with an end-of-life delirium or anxiety associated with a physical symptom like dyspnea or pain. Palliative sedation should also not be used by the request to avoid future potential symptoms or family perceptions. However, in this article in which was reviewed, the use of palliative sedation was compared in different European countries. It is discussed with increasing use in non-physical symptoms. They do explain this intended use is very controversial, as it is very difficult to determine if the symptoms of psychological distress are truly refractory. The studies cited in this article indicate an increasing trend in the use of terminal sedation in the mentioned European countries.
Now that we have reviewed the indications for advantages and disadvantages of sedation at the end of life, can you discuss the findings of this literature review that you've done?
Sure. As I have mentioned before, this article review consisted of results from different European countries, including Denmark, the Netherlands, Belgium, Italy, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. The subpopulations that they have mentioned involve children, elderly, so 80 years and above, cancer patients, those with dementia, and those with ALS. Palliative care was provided in homes, long-term care centers, hospices, and inpatient care units, palliative care units. Researchers found that from 1995 to 2002, there was an increase in requests from patients from 19 to 34% wanting palliative sedation. It was also noted in all of the studies that more than 85% of the patients died within a week of starting the terminal sedation. Interestingly, it describes that some cases of the continuous sedation until death had been performed with the intention or co-intention to actually hasten our person's death, which is something that we do not usually do in Canada. The article mentioned the use of palliative sedation was greater when a palliative care team was involved, or that if the family doctor had some palliative training. Some of the possible reasons for the increase in frequency of use of terminal sedation include the broader range of intolerable symptoms, including non-physical reasons. So fear, anxiety, psychosocial distress. It also appears that increased awareness amongst healthcare workers and access to services have contributed to this noted increase. Finally, patients and families have an actual greater awareness of this end-of-life treatment. And in Europe, they had done a lot of public campaigns about end-of-life and palliative care treatments and definitely had mentioned this.
Julie, are you able to explain some of the differences from the countries involved in the review of those guidelines here in Canada?
Sure. It was definitely interesting with my past medical experience with palliative sedation in Ontario that I wanted to kind of know the differences between the two countries. So as I still work in the community and our local hospice, I am fairly familiar with Ontario's guidelines, use of and monitoring of the use of continuous sedation. One of the differences is that terminal sedation in Canada will not be used to hasten death, and it is not to be used for the psychosocial symptoms. Even though there is no legislation governing the use of palliative sedation, there are some regulations regarding its use. McMaster University in Ontario published updated guidelines in 2020. They state continuous palliative sedation therapy is relatively uncommon in Canada. It is documented that the use of this treatment in hospice and home settings was actually less than 5%, but higher numbers in a palliative care unit where the more complex cases were. McMaster also reiterates palliative sedation is not a form or substitution of MAID. Like the study countries in the article, controversial indications include spiritual, social, psychosocial, and existential distress. Also, interestingly, the type of medications primarily used for sedation are different. While the European countries all use benzodiazepines, such as Ativan, with or without other medications, the use of opiates alone did decrease from 31 to 17%. And of note, opiates should not be solely used for sedation. In Canada, midazolam, nosenan, and phenobarbital are used primarily. It is important to not stop the concurrent use of opiates for symptom control. McMaster guidelines also stress the importance to use the lowest dose of medication for the lowest level of sedation to control symptoms. Assessment and monitoring is a very important skill to titrate the medication to keep at the level of sedation required. Using the RAS, or Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale, is one way to monitor the desired level of sedation. So in our area, when the doctor orders it on the Bayshore form, there is actually a section of what level of RAS they want the patient sedated to. Medications can be delivered by intermittent sub-Q administration or via a sub-Q CAD pump. According to McMaster's policies, lorazepam is the fourth line option compared to European practices. On a final note, the use of continuous palliative sedation may be an ethical and controversial consideration to some healthcare professionals. It is very important that the team, patient, and family are well supported. Open communication between the doctor and nurses regarding responsibility is imperative. Often palliative care physicians will get the opinions of the other team members, so the decision to initiate therapy is not placed solely on one person. Communicating the goals of care and reason for sedation needs to be done to deal with any emotional and professional issues that may arise. Often a clinical debrief may be of use, especially with the medically complex or if moral distress is important.
Thank you for that very relevant information, Julie. Just to help our audience, could you think of a story or an experience of a family and patient that you've cared for that you could tell us about their journey with palliative sedation?
Sure. I could probably explain one of the most controversial and morally distressing ones that I've experienced in my 25 years of nursing. We had a family that was from a different culture, and I don't remember which culture they were from. The patient herself really wanted sedation, pain medication, all that kind of stuff, but her parents and her husband was kind of torn in between what his wife wanted and what her parents wanted, because they were the matriarchs of the family. The parents did not want her to have any pain medication or any sedation, even though she was suffering physically and emotionally. The family physician did order palliative sedation, and it was placed upon the nurses to not tell the family.
That's very difficult.
The patient, the husband knew, but it was very difficult. It placed a lot of moral distress on the healthcare professionals that were there. We did what the patient wanted because she was still competent to make that decision. And her power of attorney was actually her husband, who also agreed. But unfortunately, we didn't want to create a rift in the family or any more dynamics that were already present. I believe the patient was not as culturally ingrained as her parents were. But yes, so she was very comfortable. We did say it was the disease process that was making her, which was probably true, more sleepy. She still had periods of increased pain, breakthrough pain. But yes, that was probably one of the most ethically difficult situations. In general, my experience in the community and at hospice, or even in the hospital, palliative sedation, it's not as well known in Canada as it is in Europe. Apparently, there has not been any campaigns that I am aware of. I do offer it as an option at the end of life. Often, you know, now that medical assistance in dying is becoming more known, I have families ask me, well, if they don't want to do MAID, what else can we do? So that often opens the door to the discussion about palliative sedation. And most of them are like, yes, I'd like that if the symptoms become intolerable. Very rarely, I don't even think that I've ever experienced anyone asking that for existential suffering. Usually it is breathlessness or pain that seem to be the two most common reasons why we would do a palliative sedation on someone. It is a little harder to do in the community. They still do it with a CAD pump, and nursing is in once or twice a day to monitor it. Initiating it is a little more difficult in the community, but it's still doable. But it's not something that, as a home care nurse, I see very often. Often they'll have a pain pump, but not necessarily a sedation pump. And often those patients end up going to eMERGE because there's an end-of-life delirium with agitation and restlessness, and the family just cannot cope. I'm not sure if that's related because that they may not have a palliative physician involved, or the home care nurses are not as familiar with palliative sedation in the home. In hospice, all the staff have taken extra courses, so we are very familiar with what palliative sedation is. Some are still a little hesitant to initiate that kind of thing or understand why we're doing it. But now with the medical assistance and dying option, that's another controversial topic as well that has come into play for patients that are already experiencing intractable symptoms, and they don't want to be put on palliative sedation and still experience terminal secretions and terminal restlessness, even with sedation, and just have their family sit by and watch. So there's multiple reasons why somebody would choose medical assistance in dying over palliative sedation. And there's reasons why somebody would rather just do the sedation. So, you know, as healthcare workers, we have to be aware of our own biases regarding these two controversial treatments. And, you know, we're there for the patient and, you know, what their goals of care are. And, you know, I do just stress to my community nurses and other people that, you know, if there is some moral distress or you're just not understanding why, make sure you reach out to your team and your palliative doc to gain a better understanding about these treatment options. But yeah, we should not be comparing medical assistance in dying with palliative sedation. They're two different types of treatment options.
So could you explain for the audience, as a nurse, how the process would work, explain to the patient and their family about palliative sedation?
So depending on why they want it, if they want it, you know, for pain control or breathlessness control, you know, there's different levels. So light sedation means they're still a little arousable, but they're not as aware of their symptom. All the way to deep sedation, where they're not aware of anything. It's almost like a coma-induced state. I do explain to the patient and the families that once the sedation starts, very rarely would we ever take them out of the sedation. Intermittent sedation has been used to help control a pain crisis. So we would give a little Nosenan or Ativan or a bit of midazolam for a day or two, get the pain under control, and then lighten the sedation and see how they manage. Most often though, once we start a palliative sedation, they stay under. They are not able to eat or drink or really communicate with their family. And, you know, some people take just a little tiny bit of medication to achieve a lower RAS where they're not responsive at all. And I had one patient who was on 9 milligrams of midazolam an hour and still walking around. And his symptom was controlled, but he definitely was not unresponsive. So everyone would take a different type of dose. Often we try one medication. If it is not successful, we will add more medications. So I've had patients with Ativan, Nosenan, and midazolam going all at the same time, just because they have such a high tolerance and that's what they require. So I've had an incident once at hospice where the family insisted that the person be sedated fully, And then one of their other siblings came to visit and wanted us to stop the sedation so they could have a meaningful conversation with them. And unfortunately, the doctor denied this request because it was not fair to the patient to be brought out of sedation and experiencing the reason why we put her under sedation. So that was a bit morally distressing as well, because I had the family yelling at me and I'm like, the doctor has said no. And so you do a lot of health teaching with them. And I've had other patients that are sedated and the family are force feeding them or trying to get them fluids. And then they get upset with the nurses because we're not doing it and we're starving them. So it is something, I mean, it's a great option to have for symptom control, but unfortunately without proper education to families, it's often that we have issues that arise on the reasons why we're not feeding them or giving them fluids and all that kind of stuff. So I often, you know, have to tell them if we force feed them or give them fluids, even though they can't swallow, it leads to a whole lot of more uncomfortable symptoms. So education is the key for families to really understand the depth of what this intervention does.
And could you briefly explain, while you're taking care of a patient that's on palliative sedation, what your responsibilities as a nurse are as far as documentation and assessment?
So once the doctor orders the pump and the particular medication they want to use, we wait for its arrival. Once it arrives, I always get one final consent from the family and the patient that this is what they still want to go ahead with. And then with another nurse, if there's one available, we would check the order against the sheet that comes from the company, the pharmacy that delivers, and with the pump settings as well. Always start a new sub-Q line that is dedicated for the CAD pump. At Hospice in Collingwood, we have a particular form that we use to measure like the starting volume, the dosing, the breakthrough dosing, what their RAS level is currently, and then with any changes, and then where the site is. So we document all that kind of stuff. Our policy at Hospice is to monitor and record those settings and RAS levels and respiration levels every 4 hours around the clock. If we're using it as a pain pump, it's just once a shift. But when they're on palliative sedation, it is a minimum of every 4 hours. Anytime we start a pump, change the dose, even if we're lowering it, it's every 15 minutes for an hour that we monitor the respirations, their sedation level. And then once a shift, we would record like how many boluses they got and stuff. I also would do a narrative note indicating the final consent. Education was done with the family and the patient regarding the fact that they won't be eating or drinking. If we have to put in a catheter or any other interventions to maintain comfort while they're being sedated. And then, you know, the pump was started, it was monitored, and any side effects that had arisen within the first hour or on the every 4 hour checks. Yeah, so in the community, it's a little different because the nurse only comes out once an hour. And often you don't, well, Bayshore's policy is to have two RNs start a palliative sedation, and then it's monitored once a day. So there's a lot of teaching involved with the family because they have to do the monitoring of side effects and stuff like that. So, and then if there's an issue, then they can call a nurse to come back out at any time. So often when they're that close to end of life, we have nursing go in possibly two times a day if possible. So it depends on the facility you're in. I'm sure the hospital has a different policy regarding their palliative sedation as well.
So in our audience this morning are some of the nurse consultants from the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. So I'm going to open up the discussion to see if there are anything that stories they would like to share or any information that would be beneficial for our audience. So could we open that up, please?
I wanted to add a point that it's so important to include the conversation around palliative sedation in the context of a request for MAID, because we still want to continue providing a palliative approach to people who are seeking MAID, and many times they do find comfort in the fact that they can have their symptoms resolved or relieved through an alternate option. So I think it's just really important to include that whole conversation. So yeah, great job, Julie.
Thanks. Yes, I've had some people who cannot have MAID for whatever particular reason. Obviously, cognitive decision making is probably one of the main reasons why somebody would be denied MAID. And often when their symptoms become even worse, their family would request palliative sedation as an alternative to MAID.
I was just going to make a comment, Julie, when you're talking about how often sedation is not usually reversed to a lighter state of sedation. I remember being at a conference many years ago and a physician was talking about palliative sedation. And it was a young mother who was dying and was having severe pain issues. And she had young children. And they, you know, her body was still, you know, quite strong in some ways. So she wasn't going to die quickly with the palliative sedation. So they did start the palliative sedation, and but they did allow her conscious level to improve. So she would wait, they would wake her up periodically so her children could come in and see her and she could see them. And this went on for, I think, a few weeks. So
yeah, you don't see it very often, but that's a prime example of why you would do one. And it would certainly depend on the reason why they were being sedated. Like the one case that we had that the doctor refused to lighten her sedation so her sister could, because she knew the minute that she lightened the sedation, the patient would be in agony. And it was not fair to the patient to do that just so the one sister who was somewhat estranged could have a conversation with her. So I think it definitely depends on the situation, the reason for sedation. And yes, I mean, I think in the young mom's case, it was very prudent.
It was a trade-off, I guess, you know, knowing that she would be in increased pain, but still have that ability to
see
the children. Yeah.
Yeah.
And having those conversations, fulsome conversations before the sedation is initiated is so important. In my experience, it's not pain that is the most common reason for palliative sedation. It's more agitation or dyspnea are the most common reasons for seeking out palliative sedation in my experience.
Yes, thank you, Sue. That was Sue from the network. Is there anyone else that would like to contribute to the conversation?
I was just going to make another comment that I think sometimes palliative sedation is not offered as much as it should as an option. And that symptom doesn't necessarily have to be present at the time, but anticipating what's going on with the disease trajectory, I think that maybe it should be offered just as a future option. So patients are aware, like everybody is, I think, more aware of MAID right now, the medical assistance in dying. But I think in some respects, I think we need to be not promoting palliative sedation, but putting it out there as a future option as well.
Right. So what you're talking about, Char, is having that discussion when they're doing the actual goals of care discussion and doing some education so that they do have a choice, and it's sort of done ahead of time rather than when you're actually right in the distressing moments of the symptom. Yes, I think that's a very reasonable point.
And putting it out there that it is, it's a natural process for ending of life.
Mm-hmm. No, and I kind of got that from the article. Yes, it was more European based, and they had done those public campaigns to make the general public aware of what palliative care is and what's entailed and what your options are. I mean, the European countries have been doing medical assistance in dying for decades before Canada, it became legal in Canada. So they always knew that was an option, but apparently they didn't really know that palliative sedation was an option. And from 2000 and up, they really did see an increase in the use of palliative sedation because of these campaigns and the fact that more nurses and more doctors were undergoing palliative education. And I think I kind of see that trend a bit here too. I do see our palliative docs in the two areas in the region that I cover definitely offer that option more than someone like a family doctor who may do obstetrics mostly, but also have a family practice. So that may not be something that the family doctor has discussed until the person is end of life. And then when a palliative care doctor has taken over the care, that now suddenly becomes an option. And I really do try, I may not mention it right in the beginning of someone's palliative journey, but definitely as time's progressed and we're focusing on our palliative approach more to comfort and quality of care, that I do mention that as an option, especially with some of those particular diseases that you could possibly see catastrophic bleeds or increased breathlessness if there is COPD or pulmonary fibrosis and that kind of thing as well. And I would say all of my clients are thankful for the fact that I spent that time with them, educating them on medical assistance in dying and palliative sedation and other medications that we could use without even sedating them to help control their symptoms. Because the fear of the unknown of, you know, they may have known somebody with pulmonary fibrosis had an awful death and they don't want that. So automatically they choose MAID because it's now legal. And I'm like, well, there's other options available too. So for them to make an informed consent, they have to be given, even for MAID, they have to be given all of the options in regards to palliative care before the doctor will even approve them for MAID. So it's definitely something that, you know, we should be educating more on, and then staff in the community and doctors in general can make that an option as well.
So we've had a very interesting and in-depth conversation. So Julie, if there was a small summary that you could make between your experience, what our nurse consultants have contributed and the article, what is it that you would say?
I think definitely education and like Sue said, not promoting the actual intervention or pushing it, but just educating healthcare workers, the general public, palliative patients, of what all of the options are. So between light sedation, deep sedation, medical assistance in dying, or, you know, general symptom control, I think they need to be aware of all of their options. So when they do develop their goals of care, that is one less stress off of them, knowing that they're not going to suffer at the end of life. And, you know, just like we push advanced care planning, get those decisions made, that is just something off their shoulder they don't have to worry about anymore. By giving them all of the options to have a good death, then that's something else. They're aware, they're like, okay, so if I do start suffering, I know I have multiple options I can choose from, and I'm not going to worry so much about future symptoms. So just knowing what's available in every area may not provide certain interventions. So just knowing what's available to them in their particular area is, I think, comforting to them.
Thank you so much, Julie, for your expertise and your contribution today, and to our nurse consultants who also contributed to the podcast. I hope you find this information useful in your practice, and we'll see you next month.
Thank you.